All right, well, why don't we go ahead and get started? So thank you for joining us today. My name is Caitlin Taylor, and I am a Recruitment and Outreach Officer at the Institute of International Education, which is a cooperating agency that administers the Fulbright Program on behalf of the State Department. This is our second webinar about the Fulbright Public Policy Fellowship, and today we are going to quickly go over the program requirements. As we did cover a lot of the basics during webinar number one, and I did post a link to that webinar in the chat box. So I recommend that if you haven't watched it yet, please do after watching this webinar, or at least before you start your application, because today we are going to be digging into the application components to give you a sense of what we're looking for. And then most excitingly, we are going to be hearing from program alumna Nina Jankowicz, who did a public policy fellowship to Ukraine in 2016. Following her presentation, we're going to open up the floor to your questions. So feel free to type your questions into the chat box as we're going along. We may stop to answer some of them, and then some of them we may save for the very end of the presentation. We'll try to get to all of them during our time today. But if your question is super specific to your situation, we might not address it. As we do want to try and keep this webinar accessible to everybody and answer questions that are just widely applicable, my email address is at the bottom of the screen here, so feel free to reach out if you have any additional questions following today's webinar. With that said, I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Vincent, from the Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, to introduce himself and to launch us into some of the fundamental information about the Fulbright Public Policy Fellowship.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. I'm excited to be with you guys today. My name is Vincent Pickett. I manage the Fulbright Public Policy Fellowship for the State Department side. We sponsor the program, and IE is the implementing partner of that program. So we work together to do everything from advertise the program to help grantees when they're out in the field and all that. So thankful that you guys can make it here today. We did, as Caitlin mentioned, we did have a previous webinar, so we're going to kind of run through quickly some of this overview stuff so that we can get to the really interesting part of the presentation, which I think is Nina joining us today. I'm sure you guys are going to have a lot of questions for us and for her, and let's get started. So the big picture of the fellowship is that fellows are selected to serve in the capacity as special assistants, technical specialists, experts that are helpful, not as advisors to foreign government ministries, but as individuals who go in and support the policies of the host government ministry. So we're looking for individuals who are eager to play that support role. We know that a lot of folks are going to come in with a lot of really great experience, but as part of a Fulbright exchange with the goal of mutual understanding and improved communications and relations between the U.S. and the host country and the people of the United States and the people within the host government and the host country, we really are looking for folks who are eager to go in and really serve in a lot of the same way that we serve here in public policy positions in the United States. That part of the fellowship is approximately 80% of the time. When, in addition to that, there's a chance for individuals to complete their own research approximately 20% of the time. The percentages are sort of broken down maybe differently in each different grant. So it's not a rigid 4 days on, 1 day off, or, 3 weeks on, approximately 1 week off, but, we can modify that based on the individual circumstances and the needs of the ministry. The length of the projects are from 4 to 9 months. That allows us for, that allows participants for the flexibility to leave their jobs for short amount of time if they can. We prefer longer fellowships if possible because clearly more gets done in 9 months than 4 months. But we do understand in certain circumstances it's not possible for that to happen. As you'll hear from Nina, I think, a little bit later, it does take a while to get things going when you start with a fellowship. So if you end up proposing a shorter fellowship, what will need to happen is a little bit more prep work ahead of time. And then we're looking to place approximately 10 globally. We have 4 countries that are eligible. So if we can go on to the next slide, we can talk through some of the other aspects of this. So some of you guys may be listening thinking, well, I know a foreign government minister or someone who is working for a foreign government right now. Maybe I can just contact them and they can hook me up. It's great that you have those connections. However, these placements are coordinated through the U.S. Embassies or Fulbright Commission. We do that as a way to, standardize our foreign policy and ensure that we have the complete buy-in of the host government, and the partnership is one that's sort of officially mandated, MOUs, there's all sorts of stuff that goes into it. So if you do know someone overseas, please do not contact them and say, I'm looking for a job in your ministry through the Fulbright program. You're more than welcome to contact them and see if they can get you a job within the ministry to be employed by the ministry. That would work. But if you're applying for the Fulbright program, please just apply to our program and let the experts at the embassy and the Fulbright commissions in country take care of those communications. We have this list here of desired qualifications. This is the first year that we're managing this program under the scholar model, and previously it was the Fulbright U.S. student program that hosted the Fulbright Public Policy Fellowship. It was a little bit complicated in both terms because we're looking for folks in the student model who had a little bit more experience. Here in the scholar model, we're looking for early career professionals with 3 to 5 years of relevant professional experience. I assume there's a lot of questions being typed into the box about what that means. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different fields or industries. It should be full-time work experience in which you're working on something that is applicable to public policy. You don't have to have served in a public policy-making capacity or have served in a position in which you're doing something in public affairs or in the government. You could be someone who is a social worker who's working cases in a mid-sized city, and you may actually have some on-the-ground experience through that and through the structure of the implementation of some programs that might be useful for a Ministry of Public Health or Ministry of Social Welfare in another country that they could learn from. You may be a lawyer who's worked with, juvenile case law, and you may then be able to be placed in a ministry of law or something like that, in which you'd be working on family law practices, child trafficking, things like that. I mean, your real work experience is what we're hoping you can bring to the table. In addition to that, if you have spent time in government or in a public policy making position or support position, that's great. It means that you have a little bit more flexibility in where you might be placed, but either of these paths and a lot of other paths are really useful ways to join the program, and I think they bring a skill set that'll be quite helpful for the host government ministry where you'll be placed. The interesting thing, though, is the language skills. There are minimal language requirements for each country that you need to meet. We're looking for people who are motivated to come in and get the work done, to work hard, to make a difference, to lead where you can, and also to step back and realize that at the end of the day, you're serving in the capacity of a public servant and not dictating or directing kind of what happens in a foreign government's office. So I think overall, as I mentioned earlier, we haven't really done this as part of the scholar program before, but we are looking for, Fulbrighters who can look at challenges, surmount them, who've come from have some interesting professional experience and who are eager to kind of learn and work hard and do good work on behalf of the Fulbright program and you know, for the foreign government ministry. So getting into a little bit deeper into the participating host governments, we can talk a little bit more about the language requirements and all the other stuff, but the way this really works is we are recruiting for positions in four different foreign governments and four places where people can go and do research. Ideally, the research that's going to be done is going to be something that is applicable to the ministries or to the sector in that country. So if you're going to Peru, for example, and you're interested in being hosted by the Ministry of Women, for example, or you have a background in doing gender work or women's rights work, any sort of research that you do, we would assume would be something in that field that then may have some positive impact on the ministry, or at least provide them with some more background information on something that they may not have known about. You're going to be there for a short amount of time. We understand you're not going to publish, five papers on what you've done while you're there, but hopefully you'll keep in touch, and some of the work that you do can either inform stuff that they are working on that are maybe professional working papers or professional white papers or policy papers or whatnot, or research papers that lead to those policy papers. And then as you move forward in your career, we hope that you'll continue to share things of relevance to your contacts in the ministry to develop sort of a long time relationship and information sharing, relationship that you have with them. So to talk about these four countries, the way that we are looking for applicants to apply to the program, we ask that people apply broadly. If you are interested in going to Cote d'Ivoire, as long as you have the advanced French that is required, you do not have to be placed at one of the listed host ministries. That's good news because we're not really exactly sure where this list will be in a year. These are the ministries that are really eager to work with us right now, or that we think that we can place people in very easily. However, a year from now, you never know what may happen. There may be some sort of environmental challenge there, or some health challenge, or some security challenge or economic challenge that might crop up, and then the shift may the interest from ministries may shift slightly to meet what those new ones are. But the point is, we ask people to apply from all different fields and all walks of life so that we can see during the selection process, at the time of selection, where the most interest from the host country ministries is. But at this point, we've framed what the current interests are in the fields or potential host ministries that have been provided to us by the U.S. embassies or Fulbright commissions in countries through their communications with the host government. So you can see that they're all broken down in terms of fields or host ministries. And in the case of Ukraine, there is a specific field that is of definite interest right now, which is strategic communications and countering disinformation. We have someone that speaks a little bit later to her work in that area in Ukraine. We can talk about how big of a deal it is. But I would say follow the news and check the happenings in countries to see sort of where the trends are with what issues are being worked on and things like that. Especially if you're someone who has a general background in public policy, you may be able to tailor your application to meet some of the current events that are kind of driving the news and interest cycle. So I think that I'll turn it over with this to the application components. We can kind of jump through this and move along. So thanks, guys. I'm happy to take any questions a little bit later when we get to the end.
Sure. Okay. I see that there are a couple of questions. We're going to save those for the end. So starting out with the application the form itself, the application form is much like forms you probably filled out for other programs. So that's going to include biographical information, a project title, an abstract, and other basic pieces of information. And then the project statement is a little bit different from what you submit for a regular Fulbright U.S. Scholar Award. It is 3 to 5 pages, and it is really your opportunity to tell us about yourself and your research project I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about this component on our next slide. And then along with the project statement, we do ask for a resume of up to 5 pages. You should list your employment history, including relevant public policy and other professional experience. If you are going to be including publications, we do ask that you use full citations. And then list the items chronologically starting with the most recent. And then any refereed publications should be listed separately from non-refereed publications. And we will also ask you to include 3 letters of reference. We recommend that your referees be individuals who can speak about your professional experience. Of course, some of you may want to ask professors to write letters of reference for you, and that's fine, but I would recommend really only one and have the others be professional references. There are some other requirements for the letters of reference, which you can find on our website, but they're pretty self-explanatory. Mostly, you know, that the letter of reference cannot come from a family member, which I'm sure all of you would have assumed anyway. But if you have any questions about whether someone's an appropriate person to write a letter of reference, please reach out. And then I want to underscore that applicants must register their referees in the online application, and the references must be submitted via the online application. So as a part of the application, you'll go in, you'll register their name, their email address, and click register. Then the referee will receive an email from us. They'll click on a link, and then they can upload the letter themselves. So you can't submit a reference letter for someone, and we will not be able to accept any mailed-in references. So it'll all have to be done through the online application. A select bibliography of up to 1 page is also required, and it should reflect the current state of research on the proposed topic, sort of similar to a lit review. It can be a list of sources, and it can be annotated or explanatory, and you can really choose the citation style, but it is only 1 page, and it would only be related to the research project, which will be taking up approximately 20% of your time on the grant. The two-part language proficiency report will be required for Peru and Côte d'Ivoire for Spanish and French, respectively. Part one is a self-evaluation, and part two asks you to register an external evaluator within the application. This part of the report is completed by an appropriate foreign language instructor through the online application reference system, very similarly to the way that you would register someone that's writing you a letter of reference. You'll also register your external language evaluator in the application. They would essentially be writing a fourth, much shorter letter of reference that speaks only to your language abilities. Then for Ukraine and Burma, it is certainly helpful if you have language abilities, but it is not required. You would just select language proficiency not required and move on. So I would recommend at least filling out part one for any languages you do have. It's a really simple self-evaluation. So at the very least, I would recommend anyone that's applying to Ukraine and Burma fill out the really easy part one if you can. And then there's no formal language test that we're going to ask you to do. And we cannot accept any OPI scores, AP scores, or other previous evaluations in lieu of these two parts of the language proficiency report. Now onto more information about the project statement, which is going to be the most important piece of your application. This is your opportunity to explain your project and the specific strengths that you have as a candidate to reviewers and potential hosts. Start with the big question. What are you proposing to do? What ministries are you interested in? Why it's important? And why you would be the most appropriate person for this grant. Is everyone still hearing me? I think I have been disconnected. I'm just going to continue and hope that you guys can still hear me. So some of the format requirements for the project statement, one is that it's 35 pages, it's single-spaced, and a 12-point font with 1-inch margin. You'll want to include page numbers as well as headers and any bullets to organize or convey key elements of your project. And then you would upload that either as a PDF or a Word document directly to the online application. The statement should specifically be describing your country of interest, why you're interested in that country, and what your goals are, and what exactly are you proposing to do, and how will you engage with the host country, including in the office and in the community that you'll be a part of. We also want to hear how you will contribute to the promotion of cultural exchange and mutual understanding, which is the ultimate goal of the Fulbright program. In terms of experience and skills, we want to know, what knowledge and experience you bring to this fellowship. Address any specific strengths and relevant work experience. We'll also want to hear about what you've done to prepare for work in this country. So talk about any of your prior experiences living or working in a foreign culture. And then what challenges do you expect to face as a foreign national working in the host country government? How are you going to adapt? And then with regard to your research project, you should cover, what are you proposing to do? We want to hear about your methodology and the nature of your research, whether it's quant or qual. And then what significance does it hold for your discipline and the host country's benefit? And then finally, how could local political or cultural issues impact your work? All of these prompting questions are on our website, and I can enter that into the chat box in a moment, but I would strongly recommend taking a look as well as the review criteria so that you can have a good idea of what exactly we're going to be evaluating you on. Vincent, do you have any other things to add?
Yeah, I would say that everything that you said was, I think, very helpful. I think one thing that you might want to consider in terms of the project statement is you really want to sell, I think, yourself as having two things. Now, let me just put a disclaimer. I don't actually select the nominees at the end of the day, but I do see kind of who comes through at the end of the process. We have an independent group of reviewers and things like that. It's not U.S. government, but I think there are two things. One, we typically see people that have specific skills and skill sets who can explain what they are capable of doing, what their experience is, and how it would be helpful. As one aspect of a successful application. Another aspect are people that can show their adaptability. In a lot of cases, you're gonna write your application and say, I'd like to go work at the Ministry of X because my skills are Y. And that's all well and good. However, that ministry may, in the time that you've applied to the time when the placement happens, have a new minister or have a new focus that doesn't allow for a placement in the office or in the ministry. But if you happen to be someone who has demonstrated skills that are transferable or applicable in different areas, you could be a lawyer, for example, who can work in a number of different ministries, or you could be someone who's who's worked on projects, community projects, or public health projects in communities or at the state level or at the federal level, who can then apply that to different different ministries as well. There may be public health in the Ministry of Women's Affairs, the Ministry of Public Health, in a research institute. In some ministry of aging, or foreign policy. I mean, there's just a large number of ways that your skills can be transferable. But it's important that you understand that, and you're willing to be flexible enough to receive placement in the places in the ministries that the host government and the embassy are able to come to terms on. So I think that's those are things you might want to look for in your application. If we could go to the next slide, too, I wanted to use that as a background for us to kind of talk through the readers of the application, which is, I think, my second point, that people need to realize as they're applying, there are a number of places where the application is reviewed, right? First, there's the technical review, which just means basically that you meet the criteria and you get all your boxes are all checked and your forms are all in. But when we move past that, we get to a review by the National Selection Committee review, which are experts or people who have have experience in public policy, have experience in maybe development programs, have experience in international educational exchange. They're professionals and academics who read through the applications with an eye towards the country and also the field to see what may make sense to push to the field. So you have that round of experts that you're writing the application for. You know, you want to take them into consideration. When it gets out to the field, you have the U.S. Embassy or the Fulbright Commission, which are Americans overseas that see things through the lens of public diplomacy and U.S. government foreign policy. So you have that sort of step as the next step in the review. And then that's followed by, if the application, the pieces of paper, the PDF now, but, the paper application makes it through to the next round through the embassy and through the Fulbright Commission, then you actually have the interview. So there's an interview that actually will happen with the Fulbright Commission or the embassy in which it becomes an interactive thing. You're no longer just a PDF. You're a person who can share more information than what you have shared on the application, someone who's able to have then personalities come through, language skills come through. One of the reasons we do the interview is because we double-check language at that point. And then the final stage with the application, applications aren't shared per se with the actual foreign government, but the information from the application makes it to the government somehow. It's either shared verbally from the embassy or maybe parts of it are cut and pasted onto like a document that they then share like a one-pager. In some cases, CVs are shared. We always check with the individual who has the CV to make sure that that's okay before we do it. But, then you have to think about that as the final audience. So what does the host government think about your application? Would they find it useful? They actually receive all the information that comes from the interview as well. Not a word for word, but the general summary. CV says this, but also we found that they're really comfortable in doing this other thing that's more interest to you. I think we could work with you there. So when you write your application, keep in mind the process, because you need to write it to ensure that each of the different steps along the way are seeing it as a viable and useful application. So I think that's kind of where my advice and things I would add would end up. And is there, in terms of the review process and timeline, Caitlin, is there anything else that we need to run through? I think if it's been up, they've been able to go through it on their own.
No, I think you pretty much covered it, and I apologize. It seems like we are having some issues with the PowerPoint, and we are working to bring that back up for everyone. So there's a slide that does really lay all of this out, and we're going to have that back up for all of you in just a minute. So until we can do that, I think it would be great to actually move to our alumni guest so she can start talking a little bit about her Fulbright experience. So we are very lucky to have a Fulbright alumna here to talk to us today. Nina Jankowicz is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and analyst with a focus on Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And she is currently a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and she was a Fulbright public policy fellow to Ukraine in 2016. A role in which she provided strategic communications guidance to the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry. Prior to her Fulbright, she managed democracy assistance programs to Russia and Belarus, and later worked in government relations and communications at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. She received her MA in Russian, Eurasian, and East European Studies from Georgetown. And then she also has a BA in Russian and Political Science from Bryn Mawr College. She's lived and worked in Russia and Ukraine. She speaks fluent Russian and is proficient in Polish and Ukrainian. So without further ado, I am going to hand it over to Nina.
Thanks so much, Caitlin and Vince. I feel like I have big shoes to fill now that you've made me seem like a very exciting part of this webinar. So I hope I can meet everyone's expectations, but I'm really happy to be here today to talk about the Public Policy Fellowship because it was a really influential year, an exciting year personally and professionally for me, and I'm glad there's so much interest in the program. So before I get into what the actual experience was like, I know one of you pre-submitted a question about which life experiences most prepared me for my time in Ukraine, and I think two were really influential. Caitlin talked about the work that I did with the National Democratic Institute, and I think that was really helpful in working in a fast-paced environment and kind of navigating cross-cultural environments and backgrounds where you're working with people who may have a different idea of how to write something or approach a difficult problem in the work environment. And you'll certainly encounter a lot of that in whatever position if you end up doing the fellowship. And I think also my experiences abroad, living and studying in the former Soviet Union, helped me know what to expect, not only in the work environment, but in daily life. And that's not to say I didn't experience any culture shock. You certainly still deal with a lot of that when you're really embedded the way that Fulbright intends you to be. But it's experience that I wouldn't trade for a lifetime. So I think a lot of you probably have similar experiences, and I would encourage you in your applications to be personal about explaining them and how they affected you and how they prepared you for the work that you're hoping to do in this fellowship. So I'll talk a little bit more about my experience at the Foreign Ministry. As Vincent alluded to, my application, when I wrote it, which was almost 3 years ago, which is hard to believe, the phenomenon of disinformation and fake news was something that Ukraine was very much on the front lines of. And I had worked with a lot of these issues in my work in Russia and Belarus and then later on NDI's communications team. So it was this is something I was really interested in pursuing during my fellowship. And as such, I was placed in the press service with the spokesperson of the Foreign Ministry, and I worked with her and her team on a day-to-day basis on a bunch of different issues ranging from social media engagement, foreign press outreach, messaging and speeches, writing and placing op-eds, including one that we worked with the foreign minister himself on that was placed in the New York Times after the election of President Trump, talking points, translation of press releases from Ukrainian to English, and then kind of overall strategy for outreach and communications for the MFA. And when I say all of that, it makes it sound much more cohesive than it actually was. At the beginning, at least, things really, as Vincent said, started up a bit slowly because I think, you know, to have a foreigner in your midst, there's at first you have to build trust with your new colleagues. And I think also, there's a lot of managing up that you as a fellow need to do to help your team figure out how to best use your skills and where they can fit you in and where you can be most helpful. And I think it's flexibility, it's managing up, but it's also being willing to do whatever they ask you and show that you are there for them because that's really the whole point of the fellowship, as Vincent said. I think, you know, in particular, at the beginning, I was working on a lot of translation. There was an issue where I actually couldn't get into the ministry for several weeks, so I was, like, texting with my colleagues. I'd meet them outside of the office. They'd have to escort me into the building, but I was doing all this work for them outside of the ministry, including translation, which at the beginning kind of frustrated me, but I think really helped build our camaraderie because it was a way that we could build on each other's knowledge. My knowledge of Ukrainian at that time was worse than it is now, and they, of course, were always looking to work on their English, so it was a bonding moment for us, and then I finally got my pass to the building, and we were off and running and working on a lot of interesting things very soon after that. So I guess be flexible, take any task that's given to you, be willing to take any task that's given to you, and that will help you have a successful fellowship. And these are, again, skills that I think you'll want to highlight in your application. And then I'll also just note that being the American in the office on a day-to-day basis and interacting with your colleagues is probably the most valuable impact that you'll have as a Fulbrighter. As Caitlin and Vince both said, the program is about building mutual understanding. So every time you eat lunch together or celebrate a birthday or a holiday in the office, those are the things more than your policy impact that your colleagues are going to have, that they're going to remember in the future. And I think, you know, when they're in high up positions in their ministry someday, and you probably will be working in government or tangential to government, those are the connections that will really help bilateral relations in the future too. So it's about being a good person, a good friend, and a good colleague. And I made really great friendships with my colleagues and outside of the office as well, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. I also wanted to touch on my research project a little bit. So Vince alluded to this, but the research project that I proposed was actually entirely different than what I ended up implementing. Because I arrived and saw a problem when I was on the ground that was much more pressing than the one that I had intended to research, which was more of kind of a historical look at some protests and how social media had affected them in Ukraine. Instead, I looked at Western support of anti-disinformation programming in Ukraine and other countries in the region, and made recommendations for how we, as the EU, as the United States, as the transatlantic community, could help to bolster those programs and better solve the problem. And I think the suggestions that I made in the paper that I wrote were useful not only for my ministry, but also for the U.S. government, and in general, that paper left me really well placed to do the work that I'm doing today. So my main message with that would be to take advantage of the research project, do something that's beneficial for you, do something that's beneficial for your ministry and maybe the USG as well. And I'd say that the State Department is really happy to provide you with the flexibility and sometimes potentially even a little extra funding to help you achieve those goals. And it's a really meaningful thing to be able to take on a research project like that. And maybe have an effect on policy. I found it very rewarding. And then also extremely rewarding was engagement beyond the office. So you're all obviously on this call because you think this will be professionally beneficial to you to do this fellowship. That's absolutely true. I think even more beneficial is the work that you can do outside of the office just as an American in whatever your host country is. Echoing that theme again of mutual understanding. So I'm not sure if the slides are back up now, but I think maybe they are. If you can see all these pictures of me, these are just a few of the things that I did during my 11 and a half months in Ukraine. I know your programs will be shorter, but I'm sure you can pack it all in. So in the top right corner, I'm wearing a Ukrainian national dress and singing at America House, which is a U.S. government-funded institution in Kiev that brings young people to this center that's very homey, and it teaches about American culture and English and helps students apply for programs in the United States. And they had a July 4th party, and I also do a lot of music and performing in my spare time, so they asked me to sing the national anthem. But it was a great cap to my time in Ukraine because I had been spending a lot of time at America House connecting with a lot of the young people there. Moving counterclockwise, this is me in the town actually that my grandfather was born in, which I got to see during my time in Ukraine. Below that, speaking at a conference on disinformation. And then to the right of that is participating in this debunking organization called StopFake, which was one of the first anti-disinformation efforts in the world, not only in Ukraine, at least responding to Russian disinformation that I anchored a couple of times. And that was kind of how I kept up ties. not only to my research material within the office and at conferences and things, but also in Ukraine itself. So working with journalists at the Kyiv Mohyla Academy to produce those segments. So there's a lot of opportunities, and I would encourage you as you're writing your application to think about ways that you'd like to engage beyond the office, the things that make you unique, because again, this is a really holistic program, and as I think the reviewers are reading applications, they're interested in all the ways that you will contribute, not just your actual work and research, but how you'll represent the U.S. in your host country. And that is all I have. I look forward to answering any questions you might have for me. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nina. So we are now going to just move on to the question and answer session of our presentation. And we've all been sort of steadily sending in questions. So I am going to pose them to whoever they think would be most appropriate for. But I think, Vincent, there's a couple of questions that applicants are having about levels of experience. What if you have more than 5 years of experience? What would you consider sort of later career? Do you have any advice for applicants that sort of fall on the later spectrum with more than 5 years of experience?
You know, I don't necessarily think that we have a hard and fast rule about the years of experience, but what we are looking for is, this is a separate program than the Fulbright, this is part of the Fulbright Scholar Program. It's one aspect of it. The purpose of this is really to kind of target folks who are, you know, mid-career or potentially if you're a little bit more experienced in your career, and if you're looking to shift it towards public policy, this may be an avenue for people to get some experience and do that. We do want people who are applying for this opportunity to be ones who are ready to sort of learn and have this opportunity be something that they can build upon for maybe a next step in their career. If you're already an expert on something and you've maybe consulted before, there are other opportunities within Fulbright, especially the Fulbright Specialist Program, that might be a better fit for you. That program is 2 to 6 weeks it's also a global program, so you have more than 4 country options, and you can do pretty much the same type of public policy activity with host institutions in foreign countries, including foreign governments. So that may be an avenue that some more experienced people might want to pursue. I think that it's important also to note that we don't have any, there's no discrimination or limitation based on age, either in the, for young folks or for folks who are a little bit older, but we are looking for people at the earlier end of the spectrum to meet the minimal requirements that we have, and I think we're looking for people at the later end of the spectrum to be able to demonstrate that this would really allow them to, grow in their career, potentially do a career pivot to something that's more policy related, or somehow show some, type of a benefit for their future as well. It's not a sort of a career capstone opportunity, or something like that. But I think that's also good advice for everyone to think about how this, how completing this fellowship is going to help, not just, your own personal career, but maybe the organization, if you're planning on going back to the same organization, how would it benefit the organization or your community here in the United States, and also what kind of impact will your grant have on the community in the host country. Nina talked a lot about how, being the American in the office or being involved in these cultural activities or just finding opportunities and spaces to sit down and communicate and share thoughts over a cup of coffee or a beer or whatever with the people from the host country or your colleagues, you know, those are the most on a lot of levels, meaningful interactions that we can have in the Fulbright program itself. So, you know, what is the impact going to be? I have a story that I always kind of tell, which is I was in the early days of this program, I went and did a site visit in Cote d'Ivoire, and I met with the Minister of Planning in Cote d'Ivoire, and we had a Fulbright public policy fellow who was given a portfolio that was a little bit more senior than I think he was expecting and we were expecting, but he was helping coordinate international assistance government-wide. And I sat down with the minister. There was a lot of money on the table, and they were actually trying to join the MCC at the time. And I sat down with the minister, and I said, you know, wow, what is this Fulbrighter, you know, what are they contributing to the office? And I knew all the list of things that he'd done and you know, these projects he was working on, and, you know, there were, you know, millions and millions of dollars, you know, at stake, basically, with some of these programs. And he looked at me and he said, do you know what Google Office Calendar is? Or Google Calendar is? And I was like, yeah, I do. I use that. It's very helpful. Me and my wife keep track of birthdays and stuff. He's like, yes, he's created this for the office, and now we all have ways that we can, you know, we can communicate with each other. We know where each other are, and it's free. And I said, I don't know how, Nina, I don't exactly know what that means for disinformation, but this was, you know, or hacking or whatnot, but this was, you know, 6-7 years ago. But, you know, I said to myself, this small impacts, right, that we can have as Americans who, you know, have a certain, you know, work processes, work ethic, certain norms in our offices that can really make an impact that improve efficiency or some of the things that we're looking for too. So I wouldn't discount the small connections that we can make in the impact, but I would think about impact when you are writing your application. I think I answered like 3 questions there, so I'm sorry I went off on a tangent, but hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah. So there are a couple of questions. I'll take these there. So the question, can you apply for the Fulbright Public Policy Fellowship as well as a regular core scholar award? No. You will need to apply to one or the other. And then many of you are asking if the recording and slides will be available at a later date. And yes, I did type into the chat box the link to where you can find our webinar archive. And we will be uploading all of this in about 5 business days is usually what we aim for. So at some point next week, you should be able to find them there. I have a question here for Nina. So Nina, you alluded to a challenge at first to find your role in the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry. How aware were your colleagues of the specifics of your fellowship before you arrived, i.e. what you proposed to do for them in your application?
I think they were very aware. So the embassy and the Fulbright program in Ukraine are very good at communicating those things. I think, and you may find this, I think it'll differ from host country to host country, but certainly in Ukraine and with other governments that I've worked with across the former Soviet Union, they're often strapped for cash and for human resources. And so in particular in Ukraine, because of the war in the east, the press service, which had, I think before I came there, a year before I came there, had 25 people. It had been downsized to 5 people, including the spokesperson and her deputy. So it was a working staff of 3, 2 leadership positions, and me. So it was difficult to fit myself in. Because I think they were just so overwhelmed with the amount of work that they were doing, and they were all working very long days, so it's a struggle, and I'm sure many of you have been in this situation with some bosses before where you need to remind them that you exist, but you don't want to be a burden on them as well. So what ended up working out for me was that as many days of the week as I could, I would sit down in the afternoon with my supervisor, the spokesperson, and she would just talk through what was going on with me. And sometimes she told me that the most helpful things were just to talk through the challenges she was facing, and we'd talk about messaging and things like that. But through that, we also find ways for me to contribute to the office. It took a while for us to get into that pattern, and then she would often have duty travel. Ukraine has a lot of holidays, so sometimes we fell out of that, but as much as we could, that is what we tried to do. And it also depended a little bit on me figuring out how to best communicate with my colleagues. I found out eventually that email is not the best way to communicate in Ukraine, at least with my colleagues it was not. Often WhatsApp, Viber, Facebook Messenger, or good old SMS text messages were much more reliable and would get a quicker response. So it's about, again, being flexible, being observant, trying to contribute in a way that is not a burden because you're there to help. And I think we all eventually figured it out.
Great, thanks, Nina. So another question for Vincent. If you have your professional experience prior to your degree, and your degree is currently in progress, are you eligible to apply?
Yes, as long as you complete your degree by the time that the project starts. I believe there is some better technical answer than that that's available on the website. But yeah, we expect there to be a lot of folks who have, you know, had a career, who've gone back to school to, you know, to do some academic training, maybe get their master's. I went to a public policy program in which everybody had 3 to 5 years before they actually went through the program, and then they would go out of that program and, you know, have the real world experience, add on some theory and some, you know, some other academic work, and then go back out and, you know, take that next step. And I think that this is a really good opportunity for people coming out of master's level or higher programs to go overseas and, you know, to really take some of what they've learned and turn some of that theory into practice, building on what they've already done prior to their degree. So yeah, as long as you have the minimal years of experience prior to the degree, as long as you finish your degree prior to the start date, then I think you're fine.
Great. And then another question, I think, Vincent, this would be good for you, is significant previous experience in the region but not in the country in question a negative for your application?
We get this question a lot. Traditionally, I think the Fulbright program, I think the scholar program says it as well, but I know the student program says, you know, significant amounts of experience in country are, you know, kind of detrimental to being a Fulbrighter. And I know that there's if you've lived in country for 5 consecutive years or, you know, a certain number out of the last certain number of years, and I think you can find that on, you know, the Fulbright sort of rules and regulations on the website. But, you know, having spent time in the region or in the country for this program, it's not it's not seen as a negative at all. In the same way, you haven't, you know, for people who have not been to the country before and who have been to the region, or maybe who haven't been to the country and haven't spent significant amount of time outside of the United States, none of it really matters in the long run as a negative. And it could be a positive. In certain ways, you know, if you've done a study abroad in Burma when you were an undergrad, and then maybe you went back for work for a year 3 or 4 years ago, and then you've come back to the States and worked a little bit here, and then you're applying for the program, that's great, because, you know, in the fact that you were there, it will check a couple boxes of some of the concerns that people go through when they read through applications, right? Do you think that they would have severe culture shock? You know, would they be able to hit the ground running? Like all that sort of stuff, you can kind of move those out of the way if you spent time in the country or in the region. You haven't had to do that because in a lot of cases in the United States, you know, you've had the same, you know, there are similar situations that you could experience culture shock or that you you know, can gain certain experience with the language at a university or working with members of a certain community in, you know, in a city through a refugee resettlement thing or you know, through church or whatever. But I think that what you want to keep in mind, and as a question of a disqualification, which is what I think the question was, it's not. What you want to keep in mind, though, is you want to have the entire package within your application be something that is seen as a positive, right? You shouldn't take for granted the fact that if you've been to one of these countries before, that you're going to have a leg up on anyone, because you know, you may have been there before, but then someone may have had you know, exceptional experience in you know, in water management or something at a city level, and has, you know, speaks the language well enough to pass whatever the minimal requirement is, and hasn't been to the country before, but that actually is something that the ministries have indicated that they have an interest in. So at the end of the day, they'll have to sit down with both applications and say which one, you know, is better based on the totality of the application. So I'd say keep that in mind as you apply, but, you know, at the same time, experience in country can be useful, but it's not required. Experience in the region can be useful, but it's not required. But it's the sort of the, you know, how all the parts of your application work together to tell your story of what you can, you know, what you have the potential to do for the ministry, and how you have the potential to sort of be, you know, as a public servant in a foreign government.
Fantastic. So each of the host country lists as like a selection of specific areas. This applicant wants to know if her specialization is in a specific topic that is, you know, perhaps an issue in the host country but is not listed as an interest area. Should she still apply pitching her particular area of expertise?
Absolutely, because that could be in one of those cases in which, you know, we got that list of interest areas, I think probably about 6 months ago. The final placements will take place, you know, 6 months from now. A lot of things can change. There's also the case in which none of that may change, but we had a case in which we worked with, for the first year of the program, we worked with Bangladesh, and they said, we only want people in the education field. That's all we want. Those are the only ones we're going to review. And I said, okay, but we recruit broadly, so we'll still recruit. And then if you see something that you like, you know, you can always move those applications forward. We gave people a heads up that they said they only wanted education, but were willing to read them all. And then a biomedical engineer applied, and they were like, this is the best project ever. Biomedical engineering? Wow, that's really going to help our ministry. We had no idea that we needed this. All we want now is biomedical engineers. So, you know, the ministries and you know, they have no idea sometimes what could be useful until they see some of the information in front of them.
Fantastic. And then we did get a couple of questions that were submitted prior to the webinar, and so I did want to sort of go over some of these. We have an applicant that actually had a question for Nina. Which was, you know, what life experience most prepared you for or was most relevant to your time as a public policy fellow? Can I take that one, Nina?
Yeah, I thought I addressed that at the beginning of my presentation, but I'll just say again, I think for me, my experience in the region was really important. And then also the work that I did at NDI, in which I was often working in cross-cultural environments, was extremely helpful when I finally got on the ground.
Fantastic. And there were a couple of questions related to whether you would be eligible to apply if you are employed by the U.S. government. And the answer to that is yes. As long as you are not employed by the Department of State. Our eligibility requirements state that employees and their immediate families of the U.S. Department of State and any public or private organization under contract to the Department of State would be ineligible to apply until 1 year after termination of such employment. Really only a problem if you are at the Department of State. Other departments, you know, at least to us, it's not an issue. I would advise you to, you know, speak with your employer, the ethics office, or your manager to see if there are any issues with taking sabbatical, but that's something that you should really take up with your employer. Let's see. I'm kind of scrolling through your questions. There are a lot of questions kind of related to specific fields. You know, what are the chances of someone in finance being selected for the program? Are master's degree holders in labor and employment relations considered for this opportunity? And I think Vincent did already sort of address that question, is really that even if your particular area of expertise is not listed, we are still very interested in seeing your application as long as, you know, you do meet the requirements, particularly the language requirements for the country. We have a couple of questions about whether how flexible the language requirements are. You know, what happens if I'm qualified in every way but I don't have the language proficiency? Unfortunately, that is a requirement. So if you do not have, you know, Spanish or French for Peru or Cote d'Ivoire, then I would advise you to take a look at the other two opportunities in Ukraine and Burma, which do not require a language proficiency.
Can I jump in with one question? Yeah, so officially there is no language requirement, you know, as Caitlin mentioned earlier, for Ukraine and Burma. I can say that if you're applying to Ukraine and Burma, I'd like to echo Caitlin's suggestion to go ahead and do a test at least so that you can have someone do an assessment so that you can at least get some credit if you do speak some of the language. I would like to say that I think it's incredibly complicated to be in one of these positions if you do not have language skills, but it has been done. It has been done, I guess. We try to pair people with people at the ministry who do speak English. However, you know, there are water coolers that people talk around. There are meetings that people go to that are done completely in the local language. So not to dash anyone's hopes or dreams about how easy it would be if you're selected to go and make an impact in those two places without relevant language skills. But I would say that if, you know, if you have zero language skills whatsoever in the country that you're applying to, that you might want to think about, not just to improve your application, but if you're interested in working in these countries, you know, to do some either, you know, there are online courses for everything now, or, you know, find someone to partner with to you know, do like a language, you know, language tutoring or just conversation with someone. Because it is, I think, incredibly hard if you don't have the language, especially in some of these countries. So, you know, if I think you want to make sure that your application is as competitive as possible. So you might want to come up with some sort of a plan. If you are selected, what you might do to improve your language skills before you go. I can say that this isn't a requirement, but everyone who hasn't had language skills has always had to work through, you know, someone at the embassy or someone in the field to kind of come up with a plan before they're able to go to do some pre-language studying. You might want to just keep that in mind, you know, and include that that you'd be willing to do that in your application if you're interested as well. Sorry, I was going to mention that a little bit earlier. I totally forgot. Wanted to get that in before the end.
There was one other question, Vincent, related to research. Would it be possible, does it need to be, you know, an original research project, or would it be possible for them to kind of join some kind of ongoing research that's already taking place, perhaps, you know, with a host institution? And not that they would seek out a host institution, but if they already have sort of an idea of some research that's going on, could they join that research?
You know, the exciting thing about this being the first time that we're handling the program on the scholar side, we have no precedent. So I would say that anything is fair game as long as long as it meets the big picture goals of what we're trying to do. We're trying to, in terms of research, you know, the research should be useful both personally and professionally to the researcher, and then it should do something to support the knowledge base or the research community within the country in a field that's relevant. And I'd say if it meets those, I mean, there's probably better stated criteria somewhere on the website, but in my mind, those are basically what they are. If it meets those two broad strokes goals, then I think it's fine if, you know, there's already research going on and, you know, you join in on that because you have the skills to do it or the access or something. I think it's fine. And I think innovation, if we're looking for you know, program-wide, any sorts of innovations this year, this is the year to propose things because we don't have a lot of precedent within the scholar program. So, you never know what you might get away with.
All right. Well, on that note, that is going to wrap up the webinar for us today. I don't see any more questions, but if you know things come up and you do have any questions for me, my email is listed on the screen, ftpf@iie.org. So feel free to reach out to me if you would like to discuss the program in any way. I did share links to the recording of last month's webinar. I also included a link to the webinar schedule where you can find a recording of this webinar next week. And some information about where you can find all of this on the website. I will send a follow-up email once the recording is ready to sort of direct all of you to it. And thank you so much to Nina for joining us today. Your insights were fascinating and I think really helpful for our applicants to kind of get a sense of what, you know, what they're actually going to be doing if they get selected for a grant. And Vincent, thank you so much. And to everyone, you know, thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope to be hearing from some of you soon so that I can help you with your application. Okay, have a great day, everyone.